Morning, ladies and gentlemen. In the interest of time, we'll go ahead with the next session. I must say, Colin van Sail is very convincing. As some of you may know, I'm on a sabbatical at the moment, but he convinced me to get up very early and come through from Pretoria. So I don't normally get up at 5 at the moment, but anyway, hopefully it will be worthwhile, the discussion. We've got quite an experienced set of panelists here, and I've worked with many of you over the years, and we're here to discuss the TCF journey, the good, the bad, and the ugly. So let me just give you a brief comment on each of the panelists. Paul Trains qualified as an actuary in 1977. He worked for Southern Life for 21 years, and Paul and I got to know each other when Momentum and Southern merged. Paul was in product development and later became appointed actuary of Southern. Afterwards, he spent 5 years in Amsterdam with PwC as an actuarial auditor. In 2009, he joined the board of Old Mutual, and he gained extensive further experience, amongst other things, chairing the customer affairs committees. And Paul is a very experienced actuary, and amongst other things, he was president of the actuarial society in the year 2000. So thanks for being here, Paul. Giles, when I read your brief CV, I realize you've got a great sense of humor. It's also been great working with Giles over many years as a consultant. He's a great consultant to work with, but also very, very experienced. So Giles was born in Kenya, but emigrated at the age of 1.5 and pursued a career in education in the UK. After graduation, he read about actuarial science, which sounded like it might be interesting. He then spent 2 years in pensions, but fortunately was transferred to Life. He became a consultant when his insurance company employer decided to relocate out of London 3 weeks after he had bought a house. He came to South Africa for a 6-month secondment 22 years ago. And he spends quite a bit of time in Africa. So thanks for being here, Giles. Nina Larish is an audit partner on the far end there. In the Deloitte Cape Town practice, she's the leader of the Western Cape Financial Services team and has successfully led the risk advisory practice and the Africa Governance Service line for many years. She's known for her work amongst other areas, conduct risk, ethics management, and governance. So thanks, Nina, for being here. And last but not least, Johan Le Roux started at Sanlam, qualified as an actuary in 1992, coincidentally the same year as that I qualified. So that's many, many years ago. Johan spent the early years of his career in the valuations department in the late 1990s. He joined Momentum in Centurion, at different roles, but sort of was responsible for the Momentum segment. And then in 2015, took early retirement to do lots of other things, amongst other things, studying ethics. But he could not really break his links with the corporate world. So in 2018, he was appointed, recently as CEO of Momentum Life. So, Johan, thanks for being here, and we'll hear some comments about ethics as well. So as you know, TCF is an outcomes-based regulatory approach designed to ensure that specific, clearly articulated, fairness outcomes are delivered for financial services customers. Firms are expected to deliver 6 TCF outcomes to customers throughout their product life cycle. Now, I'm sure most of you, if not all of you, know that the 6 TCF outcomes. In the interest of time, I'm not going to go through them. I'll just quickly page through them for you to look at, and hopefully the panelists can, throughout the comments, refer to some of the outcomes. I guess the critical point here is it's practical outcomes and outcomes throughout the life cycle, you know, the product life cycle. So I guess from point of sale right to the end to claim stage. Clearly culture plays a big role, information plays a big role, advice is important, policy health, reasonable expectations is important, and then clearly there need to be no, or all post-sale barriers need to be removed. So let's start the discussion, and hopefully there will be time at the end for some questions from the floor. So as we go through the discussion, please start thinking about the question you want to ask any of the panelists. So let's start by just looking at the practical implications of the introduction of TCF. And if you look at different approaches adopted by companies as far as product development is concerned, have we noticed any changes in product design as a result of the introduction of TCF? Paul, can you maybe start commenting on that?
Is this mic on? No. Hello? Can you hear me? Yeah, so as Nicholas said, I was chairman of the Old Mutual Life Assurance Company's Committee for Customer Affords, a board subcommittee, which was a natural home for overseeing the implementation of TCF, both as a project that had to be embarked on, and typical of all these enormous projects, required lots of management, persuasion. But I think the crucial thing was that at being a board subcommittee, we were able to ask questions of management, and you know, they couldn't ignore us. And so when we wanted where we wanted to see practical changes occur, both in product and in service and in other aspects of the product life cycle, we were able to make it real. The danger of TCF is that people imagine what it actually means to treat customers fairly, but everybody thinks they're really treating their customers fairly. And it's only when you really put individual circumstances, claims, complaints, the newspaper allegations, whatever, to the test under these outcomes, will you very quickly realize that it's much more than a simple thing. And as I said at the meeting on Tuesday, I think it's a culture change, but my experience in life has shown me that culture and attitude changes much quicker when behavior has to change than just talking and trying to persuade people. I think apartheid is a classic example. When white people had to live side by side with black people, did they realize that they could do so and that they were perfectly able to do so? Before that, you could never persuade somebody to want to live side by side with people of color. So, and then there's one particular aspect that led us to realize that the life insurance industry in South Africa is effectively being captured by the advisor force for many, many, many years. And so, for example, if you wanted to know what was a good product, I saw it in product development, you'd ask the brokers, what do you think is a good product to sell? You're never going to talk to the ultimate policyholder. And Mutual threw that over and said, we're to do our customer value proposition work, we're now going to talk to customers rather than and advisors. And I'll come back later to refer again to this fact that we're still, in a lot of ways, captured by the advisory body and not looking at the customers as the end consumers. Thank you.
Thanks, Paul. Nina, do you want to add anything that you've seen in practice, any changes in product development practices?
So maybe I'll start with, I came from Cape Town this morning, so I got up a bit earlier than you. But I had the benefit.
But you're not on sabbatical, eh?
Yeah, that makes it worse. So in the context of TCF, and Peter alluded to it earlier, some of us were on the panel in Cape Town on Tuesday as well. So I think there was a long discussion around culture, and I think perhaps what we're talking about here is treating customers fairly, but it is also moving towards, for me, conscious capitalism. And this notion that one can make money while doing good. The two are not mutually exclusive, and we should focus on that. And I know the later speaker on Zing covered some of that topic in Cape Town, and there was a specific question around, you do it for the greater good, but you've patented the concept, not taking anything from his speech. And I think that's exactly where it lies to me, that we should move away from thinking we can't make money while doing good. Now in that context, we referred to fair products earlier, because the question is really, really centered around product development. And in my years of consulting in this space, nobody thinks that their products are unfair. But if you ask them, will you sell this to your sister? Then the answer is very often, I will, but X, Y, Z. And I think that's a bit of a test for us. to say, is it really fair? And I think for me, some of the biggest changes we've seen was a far more holistic approach to considering the customer need in the product development cycle. And I don't think it was drastic. I don't think we saw many products simply being cancelled or anything like that. But I think there were tweaks, and those tweaks were very necessary by the time the regulation hit South Africa.
Yes. Yeah, thank you very much for that. Johan, I'd like you to comment on the, I guess I'm going to ask the next two questions together. Give us examples of success stories that you've been involved with where applying TCF made a positive difference to customer outcomes, but then, I guess, at the same time, maybe also just give us your view on a story that's not really helped at all, where an example which, an area which, in fact, where TCF has hindered real change. So give us a positive and a negative.
Looks like I'm getting all the interesting questions, especially the second one, Niklas. Maybe I think starting with the first one, obviously been involved with many, I think, legacy books, you know, over the years. I think that's where many of these interesting conversations actually live, and I mean, it's just practice changes, and you need to acknowledge that. You know, how do you deal with those interesting challenges? Now, I've seen many, I think, repricing on legacy products. You know, we've had some forced by regulatory intervention. When was that statement of intent exercise? The 10 years, it's quite a while ago. But even then, you know, being part of many, a company that was involved with many mergers, I think, often just decided to improve something like Serena Values, and being part of many conversations around Fair Practice Committee meetings where the board actually decided to reduce fees, you know, on existing books or make changes that are also applicable. So there are many examples, and I think TCF did play a role in that. Your second question, I think, is a bit tough. You know, what can go wrong? And I think maybe at risk of sounding a bit philosophical, the interesting thing for me is actually, I think, outcome 5. That's the one that speaks to, products must perform as expected, you know, by clients. What do you do when that does not happen? You know, when products don't perform according to expectations. Now, what I'm trying to say is, what's the consequences? And it's almost as if we're saying, and so it's not what can go wrong. I'm more asking the question. It's as if we're saying, you know, there should be some consequence. You know, when products don't perform according to expectations. Now, should there be a consequence if the organization has done really, you know, tried its best for that product to perform according to expectations? You know, clearly the client's disappointed. Should there be some form of retribution? So what TCF, I'm asking around TCF is it blurring the lines between customer consequences when products, obviously you need to meet your obligations. I mean, there's no question about that. If you don't meet your obligations, I think we can argue the customer is wronged. You need to settle that definitely. But if the product, products don't perform according to expectations, you know, clearly there's a disappointment in the room, but should there be some consequence? And I think we're struggling with that at the moment. So maybe a metaphor might be, and I don't have daughters, but let's say if I had a daughter, you know, she goes out maybe in grade 12 on a date with her boyfriend, and you as a father will say, listen, you know, won't you be back 12 o'clock tonight? Now, is that an expectation or an obligation? You know, and what are the consequences when she's not back 12 o'clock, you know, at home? Now, depending on who you speak to and which family structure you have, you'll have different results. I think, for me, this battle between should there be redress when you don't meet expectations versus not meeting obligations, which clearly you need to do something. I think we struggle with that a little bit.
Yeah, sure. Sure, Nino?
So I completely agree with the meeting expectations, but I think, and it possibly applied to the metaphor as well, the question is whether, I think it's easier to manage the expectation if the product is well understood. And I think if we don't deal with understanding but properly, it is far more difficult to manage that expectation. So for me, there's really three questions here. Did the customer need the product? Did he understand the product? And did he get what was promised? And sometimes what was promised is not what he hoped for, but But did he understand the product well enough to know that hope it has risk in? So I think for me the crux lies in that managing the understanding.
Okay, that's quite helpful. Thanks very much. Giles, I want you to comment. We've got a room full of actuaries, so the role of the profession. Please give us your view. What role should the profession play to change industry approaches? And at the same time, can you comment on industry practices that may come back to bite us and where the profession has got a particular duty?
Okay, right. So my job to tell you what to do. My feeling is that the profession's heart is in the right place. I think when I look around the room, there are lots of people I know that want to do the right thing by our customers. But I'm not sure we've managed to put that into action particularly well. When I look at the practices in the credit life space, I feel as if the actuarial profession, which had a role to play, has not played it. And that is actually true in South Africa. So one area of legislation where product regulation has had to happen outside the Life Insurance Act, because we haven't got it right. But it's actually also true elsewhere in the world. We're watching now the Royal Commission in Australia pinpointing quite nicely the failures of banks in their selling of credit insurance. So it's a global failure, and I think we've got to think quite hard how we should put what practice we should put into place to avoid the kind of errors that actually have already happened, and to spot the things that are already still happening before we have our own. Well, obviously, we can't have a royal commission, but whatever commission it would be. I think the one area that I would pinpoint, obviously outcome 5 has been highlighted, I would actually highlight outcome 3, which is, in case you don't remember it, that customers are given clear information and kept appropriately informed before, during, and after the time of contracting. Okay, my dictum is you cannot underestimate the level of ignorance that the average consumer has about financial products. So I have had the pleasure of explaining the product that my parents had already bought to them, and these are 2 university graduates. It needs to be explained and re-explained and examples given, and somebody said in Cape Town, there's no consumer bodies doing that explaining. We go straight from what the life insurance companies offer through to hellopeter.com without all that consumerism helping customers to choose the right product. And I wonder whether the actuaries have a role to play to promote that consumerism, not to do down their companies, but actually to help their companies sell the right kind of product.
Paul, as a very experienced actuary and past president of the Actuarial Society, some comments from you on the role of the profession and then also industry practices that may come back to bite us.
I think Giles, you reversed the order of answering this question, so Giles was able to steal my thunder. So yes, I believe that in the absence of a regulator who doesn't understand that his main job is probably consumer education rather than brandishing the whip at us, and in the absence of really knowledgeable financial consumer journalists, Yeah, the closest we had to one was that gentleman who ran the Argus for many, many years, but he's retired. But even so, he wasn't necessarily as knowledgeable. I think we, the society, can, and now we've got the funds, B, we've got enough people working, studying at university and working for companies who are not beholden, or they feel they're not beholden to the life insurance employers. We should actually fulfill that role. And I did suggest it to the president on Tuesday, that you should really consider seriously that. I believe that if you were to do a survey of all the current members of ASSA and ask them, putting the issue in the back, in highlighting the issues, that they would all, I think, agree that the society is probably the best placed body in the country to do so. And I urge the council and members to really consider how we can do that. I've got a particular pet hobby that you've heard me talk about many times, where I think we're going to be bitten badly, and that's in the living annuity area. Just dug up some statistics from ASISA. The latest one was 2016. There are already 500,000 living annuitants in this country. They've already invested over 400 billion rands. And remember, these are not voluntary purchases. These are just people who had this money maturing in a retirement annuity or another pension vehicle and were persuaded, often as not, because of their own ignorance, to place their money at risk in a living annuity as opposed to buying what we've always been here for, providing certainty through insurance via a conventional annuity. The average size of that investment, if you do the sums yourself, 400 billion divided by 500,000, is just under a million each. We know for a fact that if you've got a million rand only in your living annuity, unless you draw 4%, you're not going to survive. Even if you draw 4%, you're going to have a tough standard of living. So the problem always is you either start retirement poor and you keep that level of poverty in real terms by having the right drawdown rate, or you hope that things will change in the future. You start your drawdown rate at some level that you can possibly survive on, and then you hope that it doesn't go worse. I think we as an actual profession should be spelling out the latter more and more. Peter Worthy gave me a good example this morning. He believes that before a annuitant is allowed to apply and sign up for a living annuity, his children should actually sign as well, to say that we're willing to take the long-term risk, that if your money runs out, we'll support you. In return for the benefit, which is so spoken about, of these things, that if you die early, we can get a windfall legacy award. I don't think we do enough as a profession to continue to point out the dangers. And I think we should, in the light of some sort of consumer witch, I don't know if you guys from the UK remember the Consumer Witch magazine, start literally giving red, orange, and green stickers to products and to annuity strategies and to run down things. We should be willing to challenge the advisor industry and the living annuity industry. Thank you.
Nicholas, can I just maybe just a thought that crossed my mind on this point? I think interesting when we ask the question, you know, what should the profession do? You know, to, and I think I agree with Paul's sentiments, but one must also acknowledge that the profession consists of the members of ASSA, and the members of ASSA makes up the profession. So I think I would actually say, answering that same, or asking that question, you're also asking what should the members of ASSA do to actually, you know, make a difference. And I think, to me, if you want to change things, you need to engage the problem. And I would also, you know, answer that question saying that, you know, it should also be a call to members to actually, you know, apply their mind on these things as much as it is also the profession. But by not engaging, you're not going to change anything. So I think the key is to actually engage.
Johan, while you've got the floor, maybe you can also just comment on ethics. I mean, you've got a specific passion for ethics. Johan did some further studies, and how are we going to introduce that subject into the actuarial syllabus, and how do we link that up with our TCF obligations?
Wow, three questions. Yeah. Didn't expect this. Now, I think I I think TCF is one component of ethics. Maybe just start there. So I'm not having a moral conversation. I think there are mixed views in the academic discipline of ethics, whether ethics equals morals or vice versa. Let's not have that conversation. I think there's strong arguments for both. But I think for me, what's important about TCF, that clearly articulates the view from the consumer perspective. But ethics is also about balancing the interests of all stakeholders. So as much as you need to be fair to clients, you need to be fair to the other stakeholders. I think, Nina, you hinted at that also. How you do that, I think, is actually the key thing, because ethics is about action. Now, what we do what we do now in the professionalism course is at least vest some of these thinking practices, you know, in the process. But eventually every problem is quite unique. But I think the essence of thinking, solving problems from the perspective of the client, you asked the question right in the beginning about product changes. I see the way where the world is going, just business processes, the digitization of business processes, the kind of user testing mindset that come with those things. I think more and more it's becoming a more natural part of the conversation. But for me, it's actually looking at the interest from all stakeholders, and you need to know where to draw the line. I think that will be key for me.
Nina, any comment from you on ethics?
Yes, so maybe just on the previous comment, it's about treating all stakeholders fairly. I remember sitting in a workshop at one of the large insurers one day, and about 2 hours in, somebody got up and said, "And what happened to treating shareholders fairly?" So I guess that it is important to find that balance. But maybe reflecting on the industry and the profession, and coming from an auditor at this point in time in South Africa, to speak about ethics is rich if you listen to the general media. But I do think that as actuaries, you are the leaders of the insurance industry in South Africa, and therefore the responsibility to manage the culture in those organizations rests with you. It is in the product design, and it is in understanding the product, but as leaders of the industry, there is a huge responsibility in instilling a culture that demands fair consideration for all stakeholders. And perhaps as somebody that moves between companies, I can hear the speak in the organization. I can compare the four large insurance, for example, and I get a feeling for what the culture is like in all of that, and that in all four firms or other firms as well. So I think it is important that we work on that, particularly with new generations coming through and Generation Z wanting social justice and want to administer justice socially. In that context, I think it's very important as a profession to focus on ethics, to focus on fair outcomes, and to instill a culture that speaks to that generational expectation.
Excellent. Just another one question, and then we're going to open up to the floor. So please start getting your questions ready. Giles, according to your CV, you spent quite a bit of time in Africa. And now TCF applies in South Africa from a regulatory point of view, but we've got many groups in South Africa with subsidiaries across the African continent where we might be a few years behind from a TCF point of view. So what advice have you got for these groups that operate in different geographies? Should we apply the same TCF standards irrespective of what's required by the regulator?
I don't really have to give any advice, because I think those standards are already being put into practice anyway for most of the South African subsidiaries, and that applies to other international subsidiary, other companies in Africa which are subsidiaries of multinationals. Maybe not in exactly the same format as a TCF program, but a lot of assessment of reputational risk, a lot of analysis of customer complaints, and particularly complaints that go to the regulator. Companies, subsidiaries are aware. The rather more interesting one is freestanding companies, if I can put it that way, the companies that some of us serve that are based in another country, what should we, maybe as ETRI serving them, be doing for those companies? I think first thing to say is to assume that companies are amoral just because they're not based in South Africa is incorrect. I see the same standards being applied across the board in an industry, at least the same spirit of the standards, but maybe without the same sort of background and knowledge of what should be applied. I think one thing I said in Cape Town is that we need to maintain our strong sense of what's right and what's wrong and be prepared to say it, even in circumstances where it's uncomfortable. I don't think I'm good enough at that, and I would challenge myself as well as anybody else to be courageous even when it might cost you your appointment.
Thanks very much. Questions from the floor? You're welcome to direct your question at a particular panelist or to the panel in general. Andrew? Daru?
Good morning, Andrew Leroux. So I'm still chewing a bit on the first presentation. I don't know if Ian Cruikshank is still here. I didn't get to put my question to him, but there's some of what he said that I would probably personally strongly have agreed with 10 years ago and that I now very strongly disagree with. And in the context of TCF, I think that the challenge for us is to continue to be intellectually and morally courageous in asking questions because the world is not standing still. And our social context is not standing still, and technology is not standing still. So that's just kind of my observation in this debate. There are things that probably with due rigor was signed off and so on at some point in the past. But as actuaries, we, I think, run the risk of continuing to drink the same Kool-Aid that we drank before, and I think that's something we have to be deliberate and intentional about, is to continue to ask the questions and to continue to create a culture in our companies where probably youngsters coming in asking questions don't just have to toe the line from the top, but can honestly engage.
Can I make a comment there?
Joshua, Paul?
I think you're absolutely right. And what opened the, for my own personal views, you know, also came from the old traditional product development. And I said earlier, you asked the salesman what product to sell. What struck me when you start actually having a TCF mindset, when you get a report, you look at it differently. So I'm going to give you a true example. It's anecdotal, but it's true. The company that I'm on the board of in Kenya, a life insurance company, has had on its individual life sale, it has had continuous for the 7 years I've been there, very good mortality experience, positive mortality experience. The actuary's response to that was to change the assumptions to reflect that lower mortality experience. His first question wasn't, why are we having such a low mortality experience? And when you dig a little bit, very simply, it's because people aren't claiming. Widows don't know their husband took out policies. The whole process is inefficient, and there's also a cultural attitude, so for, you know, not believing that insurance companies will pay out. And that's a vicious circle, because that's why you can't sell policies. But just having, in my own mindset, having a different way that I looked at those numbers, I saw expected deaths 14, actual deaths 1. In the old days, I would have said, wow, fantastic mortality experience. Now I'm saying, that's wrong. Our very reason for existing is to pay claims, and we're not doing it. And I think I would urge all of you to try that mindset change in your daily work. Try and see, put yourself in the customer's shoes.
Thanks, very valuable comment there. Further questions from the floor?
Hi. I have what I think is probably quite a simple question, and it's something that I've been struggling with for a while. Does market segmentation help TCF or hurt TCF? I'm specifically thinking now about our lower income market segments and middle income market segments for risk products, and over time, I've really struggled to understand why we are comfortable with extracting such generous margins from the lower income segment. understand that we justify it by saying it's riskier and people are averse to underwriting, etc., etc. But if you were to put both products on the table in front of someone and explain to them that you're going to get more value for money if you're willing to just have a couple of pricks, would that change the story? And is it okay that we still continue to sort of box people and indirectly, possibly, treat them unfairly by just segmenting them in the first place?
Johan, you look like you want to volunteer.
Yes, thank you, Niklas. Maybe if you made a lot of comments. Number one, I think we must talk about segmentation or the value of segmentation. That's actually an inherent a question. But you know, I've also seen not necessarily. I've seen the opposite as well. You know, certain market segments where we believe, you know, customers are being potentially exploited. Margins aren't. That's great. But I think the key is, I think at a principal level, I think that's where we need to start. You're asking the outcome question, but I mean, at a principal level, logic dictates that if you focus on a segment's needs well, you should be able to construct appropriate solutions for that customer segment. So I think then, from a business perspective, you know, what do you invest? What is your intent? Do you really understand that client? Are you able to construct an outside-in view, sort of, from that? For that customer in terms of products, then I would say it should be beneficial. It should support TCF. You've raised, however, interesting a question. Now, you don't see it in practice. Now, maybe, I mean, I don't know if anybody else here would like to add to that, but I'm from a principal level, I certainly think segmentation is a good thing. Nina, yes, help me here.
So I think on segmentation, the... if we look to the UK, that's probably the strongest in conduct, the strongest regulator. If you look at the cases brought to them, it's either through media, because they've got a very active and informed media in this space, but the other two main indicators they use in their audits is the profitability and the claims ratio. So those two is what they look at. So, but generally, across the world, it is regarded that segmentation leads to a better understanding of the need. But on top of that, I will put the moral or ethical or whatever argument that I think in South Africa and maybe in Africa generally, we very quickly go towards banking the unbanked, insuring those that are not insured, providing credit for those that can't prove income, and all of those statements that actually gives us the moral high ground in saying that is our business model. But if we really analyze those products and if we start just maybe with the granting of credit, we grant the credit, we can't do the income assessment, and we say it is a mother who needs to buy school clothes for children, and that is the arguments we make in court around this. We grant the credit, within 3 months of not paying, that interest-free six-month loan become a 12-month fully interest loan with collection fees. On top of that, there's usually insurance product. There's many things we throw in. And if you actually look at it, you very quickly get to a disproportionate profit margin on the entire suite of products sold on the basis of giving a mother a chance to buy a pair of school shoes. So I do think in that, and I'm not sure this is deliberate. I think we start with a moral intent, and then the product develop in a certain way. But I think we do need to put our lenses on and say, when we get to these project profit margins that's outside the norm, we do have to ask, why is it that happens? Is it simply a risk adjustment, or is it just so easy to get those margins in that segment? No.
All right, last question from the floor.
Hello, I had the pleasure of attending the African Insurance Forum, and there was a Kenyan actuary who made a comparison between insurance and Bitcoin. And he said the argument that the insurance products are complex relative to the Bitcoin has always been the reason why we have been unable to penetrate certain markets. Bitcoin, in his presentation, has overtaken penetration within Africa. So from that context, he said we don't have an excuse. So this speaks to the policy wordings. When I read through a policy wording, I'd like to think my education was comprehensive. I failed to understand it myself fully. So how do we expect consumers to then be able to read a policy wording and understand? And I think it speaks to, Nina, your comment about expectations. So why is it that we're not looking at simplifying some of the details so that they're able to be understood by a normal person?
Anyone wants to comment on that? Giles, you smiling? So
I'm just smiling because it's a difficult question to answer. That was a rather complicated statement come question. The actual question was about explaining the policy. I think we just underestimate the amount of work involved in doing so, and it's not just work at the point of sale, it's work beyond the point of sale, and that's going to cost us time, or other companies we serve, time and money. It's very difficult to put forward a investment case to do that, even though I think it is worthwhile. I think we've got a big challenge. If I can go back to the earlier question on the profitability of products at the lower end of the market, particularly funeral products, it's not just about the pricing, it's also about a failure of competition. I'm going to answer the question with a question, which is, why hasn't competition resulted in rates coming down to might imply a better rate of return to policyholder? I actually don't know the answer to that, because there's so many companies operating in this space, you'd have thought rates should come down.
All right, thank you very much. I think in the interest of time, we need to close the session. Maybe just a last comment from me. I've been serving on the Fair Practice Committee of MMI for many years, and clearly the legacy issues and dealing with legacy issues is a big theme. And what was considered fair 10 years ago, 10, 15 years ago, is looking through today's lens, looking at the 6 outcomes, not necessarily fair. And quite often, we've not communicated often enough with historical policyholders in the past, kept them up to date, managed their expectations. So clearly that's a big area of responsibility for actuaries, but I guess we also need to ask ourselves, are we adding to the legacy issues that the next generation will have to deal with in what we're doing today? So let's at a minimum try to minimize further legacy issues, and let's try and deal as well as we can with the historical issues. Thank you very much to the panelists. Certainly been very interesting. It's a very broad topic, so we've just scratched the surface. Clearly you are welcome to engage any of the panelists directly afterwards in the tea and coffee session that will now follow. Nina is actually not a member of the Actuarial Society, so she gets a special gift today. So Nina, please come and get your gift. Yes, and please just give the panel a round of applause. So ladies and gentlemen, we're supposed to reconvene at 10:30. I guess 10:35 will also do. So enjoy the tea and coffee.